Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Good evening, Windy.
And there's no Nathan this time out, or there might be a bit later. He might drop in some thoughts. Basically, we couldn't get our calendars to align, but we also thought we needed to cover the City game because there's so much to say, and this is the best way we could do it. So, first off, Bardi, how did you find the game?
I was at a match. It was a quite a stressful game because obviously they had the ball for large periods of time. Ignoring the kind of chances that they missed, it was very similar to the Liverpool match, as in we knew to stay in the game as long as we can, and then as we move towards the last kind of final quarter of the game, then we'll push for it and try and win it. I think the key thing against teams like City and Liverpool is not to be out dead and buried by 50, 55 minutes.
Mm. And Mourinho, kind of, he's famous for keeping a team in a game, isn't he? And then turning the screw later on. I felt like in this one, the defensive setup wasn't quite as well. There wasn't such a low block, and in the Liverpool game, Aurier was essentially playing as a right winger who then dropped into a back five. That wasn't the case for this one. So we went back to the lopsided back four with Tanganga very much tucked in on the left, and Aurier playing a little further forward on the right. The three man midfield with Dele to the left, Winks in the middle and Lo Celso to the right. That midfield worked quite well, I thought.
Yeah, I thought it worked fine. I think Winks had one of his best games in a Spurs shirt. I think Dele was a little bit... I could see why Dele was there, to add some physicality to that midfield, because Winks and Lo Celso are both quite slight despite their being quite tenacious midfielders. But I just think it was a bit... He had a poor game, Dele, and I think Son, despite scoring, also had a poor game. And I think their poor games didn't help us in the counter-attacking style that we'd set up. But, you know, I'm not gonna get too down about it. I still think it was a fantastic result. But yeah, I think Dele and Son had some... They had a pretty weak games, both of them.
I guess the defence for Dele is that he got absolutely crunched by Sterling. I don't know if you've seen the replay, but it was a really nasty tackle from Sterling over the top of the ball into Dele's ankle. And it was when I first saw it, I thought, this is going to be a bad one. He's going to be out for a long time because his ankle just completely bent under the force of Sterling's challenge. And it's one of those situations where when you see the challenge in normal speed, it looks... not too bad. It looks kind of like any other challenge, and then you see it slowed down, it looks terrible. So I was not that surprised in hindsight that he wasn't sent off for it, but when you saw the first slow-mo replay, I was thinking that's a red card all day long. Did you have a feeling from within the stadium that it was a bad tackle?
Yeah, it's very hard to tell these days with football because players go down and they tend to stay down, but you can kind of judge the reaction of the players around it and who look at it, and immediately you could tell that something wasn't quite right, which is strange considering it was Sterling. I don't think he's renowned for putting tackles in like that. It was a bad challenge. I can kind of see why he wasn't sent off and why people think he should have been. It's a difficult one. I don't think it was malicious, but I think it was clumsy and a little bit negligent, which probably did warrant a red card.
Mm. And that was one of a number of controversies. So in the first half, we then had a penalty decision, which was unique in the sense that the game carried on for 2 minutes. because the ball didn't go out of play. Let's talk a bit first about the tackle from Aurier. Was it a clear penalty from your perspective?
Yeah, I thought penalty as soon as I saw it. But you have to kind of admire Man City. They're very smart, especially Aguero, that it's almost like they're telling VAR or the referee. They're saying, look, you need to focus on this. Aguero wasn't injured, but he stayed down. He made sure the cameras are on him, and he made sure that this tackle wasn't going to be forgotten. Because Mike Dean said he got the ball. And, you know, I don't think it was a clear and obvious error. I don't think it was a blatant penalty, but obviously you've seen them given. But they were very smart in the way they did it. And I expected Man City to boot the ball out immediately to kind of force VAR's hand. But when they didn't, and the time moved on, in the crowd, we kind of relaxed because we all held our breath when we saw the tackle. But then as the time went on and on and on, we kind of like, oh, okay, it's not going to get called back. But obviously we were wrong.
And now that's happened once, you kind of won't be able to relax because you'll just be thinking, God, as soon as the ball goes out, we're in trouble here. But it was interesting that that was Aurier's second sort of similar challenge in the box. And I think it was Jamie Carragher in commentary said when he made the first one, he made a point about Aurier being particularly rash in those challenges and desperately wanting to win the ball every opportunity, even when it's not possible. And we've seen a lot of good from Aurier over the past few weeks. I've been, you know, eating my words a little bit. But this was kind of Aurier at his worst, where he's too rash. He's too eager to win the ball in situations where he really doesn't need to. And we should have been punished. Fortunately, though, we weren't, because Hugo Lloris, who actually came off his line a little bit too early, made a terrific save. And he's becoming a bit of a penalty save expert. What did you make of the save?
Yeah, I just want to, one more point, bring it back to Aurier, because there was a tackle he made on Aguero right in towards the end of the first half, which was probably quite rash and everything else, but it was a brilliant tackle. And he was the one that kind of forced Aguero wide. And then when he ended up shooting, he hit the side netting. So as with everything with Aurier, there's a good and a bad. And sometimes his rashness and his willingness to dive in can be great. But then there is also the times when an attacker has his back to goal, like Mane at Anfield, where he should really back away. But going to talk about Lloris, it's been great to have him back. I thought, bar one moment in the second half, he was controlled, he was great on corners, he was a sense of authority, and he was coming off his line. And he's proven himself again to be a world class goalkeeper and somebody that we've definitely missed.
The next controversy came immediately after the penalty save, where the ball comes out, Lloris goes after it, thinks he can get there, Sterling toes it out for what's going to be a goal kick, and then goes to ground. I must admit, when it first happened, I thought that's a penalty. Did you get the fear?
Yeah, I had the fear immediately. I thought he'd done a Gomez against Blackpool.
Yeah, that it did remind me of that as well.
He was just so excited, and he just bounded after it like an Alsatian running after a tennis ball that's heading towards a dual carriageway. He needed to stop and just take a breath, and then realise that the ball was going miles away. There was no danger. He didn't need to go after it.
And when it wasn't given, we then have Mourinho and Sacramento absolutely hilariously coming off the bench to petition for a second yellow card for Sterling, who's been booked at that point for the challenge on Delhi. What did you make of that situation? It was quite unique.
Yeah, I think I need to go and sit one game in the West Stand and watch Mourinho up close, because I've done it with Pochettino and I found him just a bit timid. And Mourinho is not going to change the referee or the fourth official's mind with his kind of antics. But what he does is he creates a question. He puts a question mark in the referee's and official's mind to think, did I get this right? And perhaps that has a knock-on effect going forward. Whereas I thought sometimes Pochettino was almost too willing to accept the official's decision. And, you know, it's nice. Mourinho is holding them to account for their choices during the game. I think we need to see a little bit more of that within reason, obviously.
Sure. So we managed to get to half time somehow at 0-0. We've had no shots on goal. Man City have had 11. They've missed a penalty, and they've missed another sitter as well. The one where, was that first half? I think where Gundogan smashed it over the bar. I think that was the first half.
That was
second half, wasn't it? Yeah. They've missed the one where Aguero's through on the right-hand side and puts it wide. They've missed various other opportunities where they've failed with their cutbacks and made a poor final pass. And I guess Pep's thinking at half-time, we just need to take our chances and we'll win this. Mourinho had other ideas, though. He's thinking, right, we've been a bit lucky here. We've somehow come in with a clean sheet. Let's try and win this game. And what he did was put Son Heung-min up front, and he moved Lucas to the wing. And from my perspective, that had an instant impact on us. I thought Son looked really good, or certainly a lot better, a lot more threatening in that central striking position. And it allowed us to kind of get a foothold in the game. It didn't happen immediately because City came out and they looked good again and they were kind of dominating. And then Steven Bergvin, on his debut, scores an absolute beautiful finish. He's wheeling away before the ball's even hit the back of the net, which I always enjoy. Did you get a good view of that goal, Bardi?
Yeah, it was down my end. It was I was on the Fighting Cock yesterday, and I've spoken about it's the first goal really at our new stadium where I've lost it as it's gone in, and it's almost like you don't really see it at the football stadium. You don't see what's happened. You've just seen the ball's gone into him, and then he's hit it, and it's in, and you have that rush of euphoria, and then as you're settling down, they put it up on the big screen, and then you're like, oh. Okay, I see it now. I see what makes that even more special, because at the game, sometimes it's the fact that the ball's just gone in. It doesn't matter how it goes in. And then you take a step back and it's almost like a second wave of celebration when you see it's some technique and some skill has gone into that goal.
Serious technical skill. It was a good ball to him from Lucas as well. We've been pretty critical of Lucas, but he plays this kind of angled chip ball into Bergvin, who, you know, chest and hit basically, and it's the kind of finish that only a very good player can make. That was highly encouraging. And then it gets better, because just when you kind of start to get a bit worried about whether City can get an equaliser, we bring on Tonga and Ndombele, and he finds a beautiful through ball through the eye of a needle to Son Heung-min, who finishes with a bit of luck off a deflection, and the crowd goes absolutely wild again, for good reason. I bet you must have lost your shit at that point.
Yeah, I mean, not as much as the first one, but I think you in the timeline you've skipped a major moment where Harry Winks, who's not been renowned for his interceptions, even though he did quite a few nice interceptions during this game and some really nice reading of the play, including picking up cutbacks and covering in the left-hand channel with following De Bruyne out there. He totally reads a corner and springs a counter-attack, and he charges through like I've never seen Harry Winks charge, and draws a fantastic second yellow from Zinchenko. Very smart, very clever play by Winks, who, as I said at the start, was magnificent throughout.
And you feel then that the second yellow and therefore red for Zinchenko kind of potentially changed the course of the game?
Yeah, for sure. And you could see that Mourinho was lining up this double substitution. I think the Lamela Ndombele sub was coming regardless of what was happening, which shows that Mourinho saw that the game, we were still in it and it was there for winning. And even when we went 1-0 up, he continued to go with a progressive substitution rather than chucking in Eric Dier to kind of fill the gaps and hanging on for 1-0, which is an encouraging sign for a manager who's meant to be quite dour. It was a very positive substitution.
Sure. Yeah, I think he did the right thing, definitely. I mean, for me, this was it was a very patchy performance. But what I loved about it, what I really loved about it, was the spirit in the second half. You know, we really rode our luck in the first half, in my view. We got very lucky. Another day, you know, we're put to bed. But the spirit that the team showed to still go forward and be willing to take chances was great. And then they dug in for the last 20 minutes as well.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a tactical formation. This isn't a tactical play that is going to win us anything in the long term. This is all, at the moment, this is all about getting the points and trying to finish in that top four. And I could see why people can be a bit down about it. And then when you figure out that we surrendered the football so many times and we were punting it long, but we're without a world-class striker there, and we're missing our best central midfielder. So there's legitimate reasons why we played that way. And people need to calm down. If we're still playing like this next season, then there's right to be concerned. But right now, it was a win against the odds, against a Man City team who, you know, they've scored 23 consecutive away games in a row, you know. So we kept a clean sheet, which just doesn't even happen for us against teams like Norwich. So there's positives to take from it. There's obviously warning signs that it can't continue like this, but it's an amazing result, and we're now within 4 points. There was a lot of pressure on us for that game.
I kind of found it very similar to the previous game against Man City where we drew, but, you know, again, they completely dominated and probably should have won the game. This one obviously was way more joyful because we got the win. And like you said, that's all that matters. It wasn't the best performance. I'm not going to pretend it was. The Liverpool performance, in my view, was better. It was more structured and more organised. I felt like we kind of held Liverpool at arm's length, whereas this one, we relied on City missing chances. But there were some moments there. There were some sparks, which were exciting. And Ndombele's cameo was great. He was really saucy in midfield, trying all kinds of things, playing some through balls. I thought Winks and Lo Celso looked really nice together again. They both really put the miles in with their running and harrying. And Japhet Tanganga, I thought, was a star again on the left. What have you made of Tanganga's rise?
Yeah, he's brilliant. I mean, it's helped him that he's been up against mostly wingers who like to cut inside on their stronger foot and ultimately on his stronger foot. So it helps him defend a bit better. But he's been great on the ball, and he's a proper little superstar, and it's great to see him playing. And I just want to comment on Winks and Lo Celso. They really do seem to have something brewing there. Lo Celso was exceptional once again. He doesn't lose the ball very often. He reads the game pretty well, and he's got a great little touch, and he sees a pass as well.
He is a proper player. He really is. He's I don't want to speak too soon, but he's reminding me of Luka Modric.
Yeah, he's definitely got that. He's definitely got that, you know, the tenacity for someone small, but he's also got the the subtlety and the way that he moves of someone, a bigger chap like a Zidane. He's a great little central midfielder.
You don't get many central midfielders these days that can beat a man, and he can beat a man for fun. He really has. He's got that kind of low centre of gravity, quickness of feet, and of course the ability to pick a pass, which is, you know, a huge weapon in our arsenal. I'm so excited to see what a midfield of Winks, Lo Celso and Ndombele can do for the rest of the season once Ndombele's got fit and got back in there, because that's got a nice blend of skills, perhaps not the best defensively. I'm hoping that Ndombele can help Winks with some of the defensive duties, but the passing ability in that midfield would be great to watch.
I wanted to talk about Harry Winks, his performance specifically against City, but I guess also in the last couple of games too. He has come into some praise, and I think rightly so. And specifically that praise has been on his passing, which I think is something that he has been horrifically over-criticised for. I think he's a very capable passer on a technical level. I think that his pass selection is pretty strong. Whereas I do think he has weaknesses defensively. Now, he has been defensively strong in the last couple of games, as far as he has the capacity to be defensively strong. But let's get back to the passing, which is that I was trying to think, why has Winks impressed everyone, or most people, and me specifically, and why has his passing been noted in the last few games? Because there hasn't been any leap forwards in his decision-making, I don't think, or leap forwards in his technical ability at all. He said, what I'm seeing is that he's playing forward earlier, not just recklessly like hoofing the ball long, but making that aggressive but smart pass early. He often receives the ball, takes two touches, turns with the ball, plays a short pass away to receive a short pass back to then play the direct attack. And I feel like the instruction that he's receiving at the moment, whether it's specifically to do with him and his game or whether it's just the team instructions, are that he's playing that ball earlier. And I think that does him a lot of good, because he's quite hesitant to make that aggressive pass. Hesitant is a harsh term. Just not quite snappy, not so urgent as sort of comparable creative passes are. So I think that the timing is a really good cue for him. I use the word cue because it's sort of like a weightlifting term, is that different people respond to different sort of instructions, even when they're performing the same things. So you might tell one person to sort of, you know, drive through the hips or keep your heels down, all that kind of technical stuff, just because different people need those different reminders and sort of directions to help form the way that they do things. So I think that earliness as an instruction is doing Winks a lot of good. I was also really impressed with new boy Stevie B. Bergwijn, he had a really strong game against City. I think he demonstrated his ability, as I sort of tweeted before the match, to play on the left, to play on the right, to play both narrow and wide in those situations, and even a brief stint up top, which I really liked. If there was a criticism of him coming to the club, it was of his defensive contribution, which is a criticism that I wasn't too hot on myself. I haven't seen it an enormous amount of his time in the Eredivisie, but it's not something that I noticed was missing or lacking in terms of effort. I feel like the complaint is probably a stats-based one, that he doesn't have many tackles or interceptions rather than an effort-based one. And I wonder if that is just a team style or team instruction coming from PSV. I don't know. That's something for me to go look back at. But anyway, the point I'm trying to arrive at is that he put in a bunch of tackles and interceptions against City. Now, maybe it's your debut and you want to impress and make a statement on any kind of criticisms, and it's your first game under Mourinho, so we'll see how that goes, but the signs on that are really positive. The boys are about to talk about the transfer window. Obviously, Bergwijn is a considerable part of that, and that's a really good opportunistic signing, as we said, and the boys are about to talk about strikers, so I'll leave that to them. But of course, in true Nathan A. Clarke trademark style, I wanted to talk about defensive midfield. It's really interesting, interesting being an optimistic word, that we were basically not linked with defensive midfielders. There was no talk about defensive midfielders. And there was even a rumour from, I think, a pretty unreliable source that specifically Mourinho has said that he's not, or given the impression that he's not interested in defensive midfielders. And I find that really strange, our approach, because when Mourinho arrived, pretty much the first thing he did, well, you know, one of the simultaneous first things he did was bring Eric Dier back into the team, move Winks away from the number six role and then eventually out of the team, and start Dier for consecutive games, seemingly in hope of getting him match fit again, finally. And persisted with him for several games in which he sort of got a little bit better, but sort of topped out below the required standard, and then Dier has dropped out the team again and Winks has become the number six again. So for me, those are not the actions of a manager who doesn't believe his team needs a defensive midfielder. So I'm going to be really optimistic, and I will say that hopefully what is happening here is that defensive midfield is considered such a priority, such an urgent need, that it's one we think would require a considerable portion of budget, and therefore not something to be done until the summer when better deals can be made at better prices and on better terms. I'm going to hand you back now to Windy and Bardi. They're capable mouths, capable voices. But I'll be back later to chat about the Southampton game, which is happening in a couple of hours.
Which I guess leads us on to talking about how we feel the transfer window went in general. There's still a lot of disappointment around that we didn't sign a striker. But we got Bergwijn, and I think we can be happy with that, particularly after his debut goal. We got Jedson. We signed Lo Celso permanently. We also got rid of Eriksen and Rose on loan. What have you made of the transfer window, Bardi? Do you feel satisfied? Do you feel like we could have gone the extra mile and got, say, Odion Ighalo like United did, or try and find someone to take on loan?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. There's a lot of teams out there with a lot more cash and wages to throw around looking for strikers. Barcelona, for example, the desperation where they are having to throw £80 million at Everton for Richarlison, and Man United having to take a loan on Ighalo, who hasn't kicked a ball since the Chinese Premier League ended in December, you know? So yeah. I wouldn't have wanted to take a gamble on Ighalo, and I didn't want to spend in the kind of money that they wanted for William Jose. And Piontek, you know, it would have been an interesting experiment for Piontek, but you know, I don't think it would have helped us long term, and I don't think it would have helped us short term either. Perhaps Giroud would have done something, but he comes with too much baggage, you know. And I don't know how keen Chelsea were. I mean, Chelsea had their own issues trying to sign a striker. So I think we had a good window. We did what we could. We moved on two players who, even though Dele said that Eriksen was still a good character around the camp, we moved on two players who clearly wanted to leave the team. So that's got to be good for morale. And Jedson looks like a decent body in midfield. So you can't be too disappointed with it, even though we didn't get that striker.
And I think you've nailed it. There would have been an element of risk with any striker signing. They clearly couldn't find someone who they wanted long term, so they tried to do a short term deal. It didn't pan out in the end. Whether that was the right thing or not, I guess we'll find out come the end of the season. The problem with taking a short term punt is not just the cost; it's the impact that has on the rest of the squad, on morale. Have you got the right characters? Are you just bringing someone for the sake of it? How will that make them feel? How will that make the rest of the squad feel? And it's tricky. It's a challenge in itself. I will say one thing I've been really pleased about, and I would say this, is that Mourinho's totally changed the way we're handling the development squad players. So he's loaned out a load of young players who previously hadn't been on loan, which is, in my opinion, the right move. And we're now at a point where all of the players who were above a certain age, so basically 20 or older, are either gone permanently or on loan. He also sold Tashaan Oakley-Booth and Paris Mogoma, and you know, they're players who I didn't think would be good enough for Spurs. So that's great for them. It lets them go off and start their careers at Stoke and at Brentford. That's a perfect opportunity for them to do that. It lets them actually become footballers rather than theoretical footballers. And it shows that Spurs are not going to just hoard players like we have been for the past few years. And we got fees for them. They might be nominal fees, but we got fees for them, and that's no bad thing. So I was really chuffed with how that's panned out as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's all... Yeah, because you know better than I do that this it kind of gets stuck. The under-23s becomes a graveyard for kind of players never good enough for the Premier League, but Spurs seem unwilling to cut loose. And, you know, if the rumours are correct that we're using Jack Clarke, his loan to QPR is a kind of a sweetener to get Eze in the summer. Mm. And I think there's another player we've also been linked with, and I think someone was spouted ITK about someone else was signing from QPR, then that's all well and good.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the other thing that comes about from getting rid of some of these development squad players is it then opens up opportunities in the under-23s for some of the better under-18 players. So you're kind of pushing forward players, giving them an opportunity a bit earlier than they might otherwise have had, which is a good thing again. We've got a production line again. And I felt like there was lots of stagnation, lots of blockers, people being hung on to who weren't really going to make it, but were just blocking the progress of others. And this feels much more carefully managed. And I don't know if it's a Mourinho instruction or whether he's just basically said to John McDermott, you crack on and do what you think's best. But it's really changed from what Pochettino was doing. And it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's a good thing. The final thing to note, and I think this is crucial as well, is the way we've handled the kind of contract rebels as such. So he got Alvarez to sign the contract pretty early. It sounds as though he's giving Vertonghen a one-year contract. And then Troy Parrott is the final piece in the puzzle when it comes to contracts and contract disputes. It sounds as though it's going to happen. Parrott's going to sign on, and that can only be a good thing. So again, big tick from me for the way Mourinho's managing the squad building. I think that's it can only be positive. So we're feeling pretty upbeat, right?
Yeah, pretty happy. If we get through the FA Cup, then we go into a nice little break in a positive frame of mind and ready to push on. We've got the Champions League coming. It's not too bad. It's not doom and gloom. We're doing all right.
It's not perfect. It's not perfect at all. But the signs are there. We're 4 points off fourth. Chelsea are totally catchable at the moment. They don't look as settled as they did at the start of the season. And we're kind of coming up on the heels. We've got these exciting, pacey players who can lead us forward. But we've also stumbled across a midfield combination that seems to work. Plus the bonus of Japhet Tanganga at the back. So things are looking good, right?
Yeah, I mean, Chelsea, totally. If you look at them now, Frank Lampard is almost starting to second-guess himself because his decisions, his substitutions, he's losing faith in Mount. He's now playing Willie Caballero in goal. He's starting to question himself, which is going to happen to a young manager. They have their beliefs, which they stick to, and then things go against them, and they start to question everything, which is good. And we've got them in a few weeks. So, yeah, it's definitely all to play for.
We're going to finish fourth, buddy.
I think we might finish third. I think Leicester are gone.
Big dog.
I've had a theory that eventually Leicester's bubble will burst. And I think they've been on a bad run of form. They lost the semi-final, which they probably shouldn't have lost. Vardy's not scoring. The Turkish guy, whose first name is Shagri, which did make me giggle a little bit. He's started to lose form as well. So when you're reliant like Leicester on 12 players to play their best every single game, when a few of them lose it, the team falls apart. So third is a possibility as well.
Well, I'm going to say fourth, but I'll take a dose of your optimism.
Good, it's good. Double drop it.
And I'm sure Nathan's going to chip in at some point in this podcast and bring us back down to earth, but we'll leave it there.
That's what he does. He's our ballast.
The ballast is back, as promised, to discuss the Southampton game. You ready? It was bad.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Barney for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindner for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at @DavyShambles and his SoundCloud @DLindner. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.